You're listening to All the Best. I'm Maddie McQueen.
And I'm Ryan Pemberton. So I want you to close your eyes.
Okay.
And imagine a rising sun.
I never get up that early. Okay. Yeah.
So imagine that you get up early enough to see the rising sun and then picture what that might look like.
Mm-hmm.
So you can see the sun rising above the horizon into a hazy sky. The sky clears and surrounds the sun with blueness. You can see clouds starting to form. And a storm blows up with flashes of lightning. And the clouds clear and a rainbow appears. So when you tried to visualize that, how detailed was the picture in your mind's eye?
So I think it's probably like a bit of a mixture between fantasy and reality, but I definitely saw a very vivid picture.
Right. So on a scale of like 1 to 5, where 1 is like, you know, grayscale, like a vague shadowy outline, and 5 is like photorealistic, whereabouts would you say the vividness of that image was?
Well, I just told you it was more, so 6.
It was more... That's funny you think that fantastical is more vivid than reality.
Yeah, it's more vivid than reality. It's like reality, but
extra.
Like a bit extra, yeah.
Okay, cool.
So why did you just make me do that?
I'll explain that in a minute, but first I want to introduce you to Adam.
So my name is Adam Zeman, and I'm Professor of Cognitive and Behavioral Neurology at the University of Exeter in the UK.
So in the early 2000s, Adam Zeman met a patient whose mind's eye had suddenly become blank.
He was a very articulate man in his mid-60s, a surveyor, who following a cardiac procedure had become unable to visualize. And that was a symptom that I hadn't encountered before in neurology, and I was intrigued by it. And after meeting this man, I went to the literature to see whether it had been described before, and it turned out that it had been. It was rare. But there were perhaps 50 cases in the neurological literature over about 100 years of people who had lost the ability to visualize following one or another kind of brain injury. So it seems to be something that can happen as a result of a number of different kinds of brain pathology, if you like. So people who have had a perfectly normal or even exceptionally rich ability to visualize can lose it.
Is this only a thing that people lose? Like, is everyone born with the ability to visualize and then due to various neurological reasons they lose it? Or are there people who just like never have the ability to visualize?
Well, this was something that Adam didn't know because it hadn't really been studied until he started to ask questions about it. So after they published the case of this man who had lost his ability to visualize, a science journalist picked it up and wrote an article about it in Discover magazine. And then people started contacting Adam saying,
I read this story and I'm really interested because I'm just like this, but I always have been. So these were people who had never been able to visualize and recognize their similarity to the patient we described, but with the difference that he'd lost his ability to visualize, whereas they'd never had it.
Over the next 3 to 4 years, about 21 people got in contact with Adam saying that this was something that they had been born with. And he started to investigate it. So he sent those 21 people a visual vividness questionnaire.
Which is very intuitive. It just asks you to visualize 16 scenarios like the sun setting in a misty sky.
That exercise that we did at the beginning, that was one of the questions in that questionnaire.
And you have to rate the vividness of your image from as vivid as if I were actually seeing it, which gives you a score of 5/5, to no image at all, just thinking about it, which gives you a score of 1/5. And these 21 folk were tending to score at or close to 16/80, so the lowest possible score, indicating that they didn't form a visual image in response to any of these scenarios. By the time we'd been contacted by 20 or so, we decided that this really needed to be recognized, described, and given a name. So I consulted with a classicist friend who was knowledgeable about the philosophical literature, and he suggested that we borrow Aristotle's term for the mind's eye, phantasia, and tag an aeon at the end, so denoting the absence of the ability to visualize. So we described these 21 folk who had never been able to visualize using the term aphantasia, or in their case, congenital aphantasia, because so far as we knew, these folk had never been able to visualize. People who lack imagery were aware that they'd been neglected. So as soon as we coined the term, I received a flood of contacts from people saying that they were really delighted that the term had been coined and that attention was being paid to this.
So why had no one noticed this before?
Well, Adam tells me there was a 19th century British psychologist who was like the first person to do a visual vividness questionnaire, but no one had like seriously focused on this question of like, are there people who cannot visualize at all? How common is it? And how does it impact people's lives?
And what are the impacts of not being able to visualize?
Well, I think the obvious one that you would think is like maybe someone who cannot visualize cannot be an artist, or at least not be a visual artist, right? Because the way that people create art, at least the way that I thought that people created art, is that they imagine something, like imagining the sunset, and then they take that sunset from their imagination and then onto a canvas. I was describing this condition to my brother the other day, and he told me that he has it, which is significant because he is an animator, which just seemed totally nuts to me because surely he has to visualize what he's going to draw before he draws it. But he described that the first time that he sees a design is when he's put it on the page. And it turns out that there are lots of examples of this. Adam explained to me that there are many, many successful artists with aphantasia, including the co-founder of Pixar and retired president of Disney, Ed Catmull.
And he was sufficiently interested to conduct a survey within Pixar to find out more about the vividness of imagery among his colleagues.
And it turns out that the man who did the character designs and animation for The Little Mermaid, Glenn Keane, is also aphantasic.
Like your brother, has no preconception of what he's going to put down. Ed showed a beautiful video of Glenn Keane at work. So he tends to begin with a kind of scribble, and then he begins to see something in the scribble, and he works with that. There are many, many iterations.
It's like playing Mr. Scribble. This is really interesting to me because I hated art class when I was a kid. And what was always really annoying to me was that I could like see the thing in my head and then I would go to put it on the page and it would just look completely wrong. I was like, that's not what I'm seeing. Why can't I get this thing that is inside my brain and put it on this piece of paper? It's really interesting that people who don't have it in their mind seem to be able to create incredible art.
Yeah, yeah. And actually, like Adam then explained to me, he's like, well, maybe it's not actually that different to the way that other artists work, because
most artists, they work with the page to some extent.
The thing that's in your mind is not going to be the thing that ends up on the page.
But aphantasic artists, especially in that they have nothing visually in their mind's eye prior to starting work, whereas most artists have some visual preconception.
So clearly, like, the ability to visualize is not necessary to be creative.
And it's quite nice to have proven Aristotle wrong in one small respect. So he said the mind always thinks with a phantasm. So he thought that imagery was crucial to thought. And I think the existence of aphantasia proves that that's not the case. At least conscious imagery isn't required.
So when you start looking at aphantasia on social media, something you see come up again and again is you see countless stories of people discovering in their 20s and 30s and 40s for the first time that this is a thing that they have. And what's most shocking to them is not what they learn about themselves, it's what they discover about everyone else.
People say that they had previously assumed that talk of seeing in the mind's eye or counting sheep to help you fall asleep, that kind of talk is all metaphorical. People don't really see anything. They're just talking as if they did. But then at a certain point, they realize that when other people talk about seeing in the mind's eye, they actually are describing an experience which is a bit visual.
You know, as someone who can actually visualize, just try to like put yourself in that position for a moment. It's the thing that they are discovering is not that they can't visualize things. It's the fact that they're learning for the first time that everyone else can.
Well, like that, he was talking about how it proves Aristotle wrong, right? That was what came to my mind when he was talking about that, was that it was just very self-centered of Aristotle to be like, this is how everyone experiences the world because it's the way I do. And that clearly isn't the case. That makes total sense to me. Why would they be surprised about not having a mind's eye when they've never had one?
Like, it's shocking, but it shouldn't be shocking. When you learn about like some drastic way that someone's experience is different than yours, it can be really surprising. You're like, I can't believe that people perceive things in such a different way to the way that I do, because the way that we empathize with each other is we tend to relate the way that we experience things to the way that other people experience things. But there are so many ways that our perceptions differ from other people's. We can go our whole lives not realizing that there are vast differences in the way that our minds work because those differences are invisible.
This week on All the Best, we're imagining what it's like to be in someone else's head. First up, we visit Rachel's inner world as she imagines the end of COVID restrictions in Melbourne. This story contains strong sexual content.
When they finally announced the restrictions were lifted, it was a quiet, chill evening. I went out into the front yard in my bare feet to celebrate. I felt the cool air circulate around my legs. The jaundiced moon shone brightly overhead. People on the street were milling around in shock, crying, hugging one another. Every dog in the neighbourhood began to bark with excitement. Someone set up speakers on the nature strip and started an impromptu party. Then we felt a low rumbling under the music, unlike any sound I have ever heard or will ever hear again. We all stopped dancing and turned to each other, our faces painted with fear. The sound was growing in volume, getting closer. It was like hearing people being intimate in the next room, but hundreds of people and hundreds of rooms. None of us spoke. Some were scared, some were titillated. All were holding our breath. Then we saw it roll over the horizon. A huge, throbbing ball of people, 5 stories high and just as wide. They were all in various states of undress, all engaged in various sexual acts. The ball vibrated with their moans and groans and gasps and seemed to pick up steam. As it drew closer, I saw how beautiful this throbbing sphere was. All the various shades of skin were slick with sweat and other fluids reflecting the bright light of the moon. They all seemed to be breathing as one organism. We all stared as the great orgiastic mass rolled down our street. I knew that I would never get a chance to experience such wild passion as I would that night. My heart was beating in my throat as the pulsating superorganism approached. By now, it had swollen to perhaps 10 stories high, and it was deafeningly loud. It was like the moaning and sighing of the entire earth. I stripped off all my clothes, bearing my naked body to the night. The ball of desire rolled past me and I had to sprint to keep up. As I caught up, hands reached out towards me. I reached out to grab them and I was pulled into their embrace. I will never forget the feeling of that pull. It was like a small planet exerting its magnetic draw upon me. That night, every desire found its home, even those as yet unnamed. Every tongue found every curve, and every heart found its home. That night of collective love profoundly changed society. I could never fuck again without thinking I was really fucking everyone in my city, in my world. I could never hurt anyone without considering that, all things being connected, I was in some way hurting everyone. I would go as so far as to say that I can no longer consider myself a discrete individual entity. Now, whenever I think about love and what it means to me, my mind unfailingly rolls towards vivid, glowing images of that great, big, beautiful ball.
That story was written and performed by Rachel Eng. It was adapted from a comic she made for 4A Contemporary Art in Sydney, which you can read on their website, 4a.com.au. You're listening to All the Best. I'm Maddie McQueen. All the Best is about training emerging Australian storytellers in the art of audio. If you'd like to be a part of the show, you can start by pitching to us at allthebestradio.com. We'll pair you with one of our supervising producers to help make your story. Our next story was painstakingly produced by the All the Best editorial team in front of a live audience at this year's Audiocraft Festival. We spoke to Sarah Allerley, creator of the podcast Brain on Nature, about how connecting with nature helped her recover from a mild traumatic brain injury.
My last memory was riding through this roundabout, and the next moment was waking up under the car. And then I sort of had moments returning to me, but I couldn't tell if I'd just created them in my mind, of like the underside of a car and crashing into metal. But I really wasn't sure if my brain was playing tricks on me, because my brain wasn't working very well for quite a long time. My name's Sarah Allerley, and I was the creator and writer and producer of the independent podcast Brain on Nature. And I'm here in Sydney, Australia. So it's a 6-part narrative nonfiction series, and it's about how going out into the natural world changed my brain. So I had a bike accident a few years ago, and it left me with a mild traumatic brain injury, and I was unable to read or write, listen to music, watch TV, look after my young kids, and I slowly discovered that spending time out in nature helped me recover. I was riding my bike just down the road in Dulwich Hill in Sydney at just before 8 a.m. on a Saturday morning to an exercise class that I did in the park. I was on my way there, halfway there, and I woke up on the road surrounded by strangers telling me not to move, and I was in a lot of pain, and they said, "Don't move, an ambulance is coming." Basically, I'd been knocked off my bike by a car. Head injuries are really complicated, and they don't diagnose brain injuries for quite a while. Initially, it's just considered a concussion. And I was just sent home from the hospital in April due to paper saying, if in 4 weeks' time your symptoms haven't improved, go and see your GP. So it took quite a long time to diagnose, and yeah, I mean, you just think you're going a bit crazy, right? And think maybe you're imagining it, because it's quite an invisible injury. Trying to explain to a doctor that, no, my brain's not working, I can't read a novel and I can't listen to a podcast. Like, yes, I might be able to look like I'm really functioning, but it's hard to explain to people that there's all these kind of other things that you can't do. I remember trying to convince the brain injury specialist, but I'm not better yet. I can't read really complicated stuff. You know, I can listen to some podcasts, but podcasts that are a bit complicated, I still can't follow them. And that's sort of hard to explain to someone who doesn't know you. In terms of recovery time, there were definitely moments where, you know, weeks, months, where I thought I was actually never going to recover. And that made me slip into a bit of anxiety and depression. And that's another thing that I found nature really helpful for. So I started going for walks down. I lived in Dulwich Hill, and there's like just a river called the Cooks River. It's quite a sort of urban park river. But I'd lived there for years, and I'd never actually really kind of bothered to walk down there much. And I started walking down there and doing quite big walks and finding that it really helped to relieve my anxiety and depression. It was funny though, because before that I'd gone to Bondi Beach and stayed with a friend when I was just like, I had to get away from my kids and everything, and I just needed silence, and I was just having constant headaches, and I went and sat on the beach and just stared at the waves. But again, my brain wasn't thinking, oh, must be nature. I was just like, oh, that's interesting. Staring at the waves, it's kind of like meditating, but I wasn't joining dots for quite a long time. guess the sort of journalist, analytical person with me wanted to know, what is it about it and how much time do I need to spend in nature and what's the dose and am I better to sit in my back garden or go to a national park? Is it the sights and the sounds and the touch or what is it?
This is Brain on Nature, a podcast about how going out into the natural world changed my brain. I'm Sarah Allerley.
I always wanted the podcast to be quite immersive in terms of the sound design and to really give people a sense of what it was like to be inside my head. And I think we achieved that. For me, really, it was about sound. And I really struggled with loud environments like cafes and bars, even this dropping my kids off at school, being in a room where there was more than one conversation. I found just like any kind of like shopping center, like I just couldn't even, it was like you've got your recorder and the mic is just turned, everything's just turned up. So when I made that connection, I realized that actually audio was the perfect format. I remember my partner, Miles, saying quite earlier on, oh, you should start making some voice memos and you could maybe make a podcast about your experience. And I was like, I'm never going to be well enough to make a podcast. Like, that's how I felt. I really was like, this could be forever. It was very confronting. I stumbled across a few magazine articles about the benefits of nature on the brain and found that there was some science to it. And, you know, I'm a journalist, I'm very analytical, and knowing that there were like facts and this wasn't just me, I was like, huh, wow, maybe I could make a documentary about this when I'm a bit better. When I first was thinking about it, I wasn't going to be so much the focus. Like there's this personal story, but then it was going to be a lot about the research and other people's stories. But through chatting to friends, people were like, no, that's what makes it interesting. Make it about you. And been a journalist for years, but never made a story about myself. And it felt kind of weird and wrong. And I felt quite vulnerable doing that. I had this conversation with a friend. She was like, yeah, people respect that vulnerability. And that vulnerability is what you draw people in. And so I just had to keep telling myself that it was good for the story. And so I went and spoke to, there's a lot of research being done around the world in this, and basically they said, you're asking the same question we're asking, and yes, there's a few answers, but in the end, I think nature's a bit too complicated for us to bottle up and single out. I think probably we are part of nature and we've sort of lost our connection with the natural world, and I think the more you can reconnect with it. I guess that's kind of where the journey I'm on at the moment is just noticing how it doesn't really matter how much time you spend or where you are. It's actually about the quality of that connection. So you can go for a bushwalk in the Royal National Park, but you're on your phone. You're not really connecting. You can go and sit in the park and really like notice that tree and look at the insects and the birds and really just tune into it and be really present to it for 5 minutes. And I think you'll probably do your brain just as much of a favour.
That was Sarah Allerley from the podcast Brain on Nature. They're currently producing season 2 and looking for support. Visit brainonnature.com to find out more. I once had a dream that Dawn French saved me from an angry mob of murderous priests. In our final story, Georgia tells us about some of her dreams.
I once had a dream that I was a bird, flying high into the sky to lay my eggs amongst the clouds. I once had a dream that I was my dog. I was in our garden, all alone, barking for someone to come play with me. I once had a dream that I was a little girl, painting a straight line up the neck of a giraffe. As the line I painted grew longer, so did the neck. It grew and grew until we reached the moon. I once had a dream that I was a little pink man on a little pink planet, surrounded by pretty pink peacocks. I once had a dream that I was sitting at the dinner table, and everyone around me was speaking backwards. I once had a dream that I was a teddy bear crammed inside a fishbowl. I once had a dream that I was a frog caught in someone's throat.
Ribbit.
They sneeze.
Bless you!
And I was shot out into a pond.
Ribbit. Ribbit.
I once had a dream that I was stuck in a spider's web. I tried to break free but was unable to move as I watched its maker creeping towards me. I once had a dream that I was sitting in front of a heater to defrost my frozen hands. I heard drip, 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 then saw that I was melting too. I once had a dream that I was rain. I could watch the glittering city lights as I fell from the night sky towards them. I once had a dream that I was floating, peacefully hovering over the ocean as whales swam silently below me.
That story was produced by Georgia Loden, with special thanks to Lee Redfern. All the Best would like to acknowledge the traditional owners of the lands on which we make these stories and pay our respects to elders past, present, and emerging. All the Best is made at FBI Radio in Sydney in association with SYN and 3RRR in Melbourne. Our executive producer is Ryan Pemberton. Mel Chun is our Victorian State Coordinator. The All the Best Community Coordinators are Chloe Gillespie and Danny Stewart. Our SYN Community Coordinator is Lee Robinson, and Matilda Fay and Angel Moran are our social media producers. Shining Bird composed our theme music, and Annie Hamilton designed the artwork. We're heard across Australia on the Community Radio Network and were made possible by the Community Broadcasting Foundation. You can find out more at cbf.org.au. You can find more episodes by searching For All the Best wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Maddie McQueen. Thanks for listening.